Hello, hello, it's Andrew Sweatman for Arthouse Garage, the snob-free film community that promotes moviegoing for personal development. Thank you so much for tuning in, and welcome to Season 2 of the Arthouse Garage podcast. Season 1 wrapped a while ago, and I've been wanting to jump back into podcasting for a while now, and with all the amazing movies coming out very soon, I thought, what better time than now. And the movie that really inspired me was the movie we are discussing this week. It is called Dr. Sleep. If you are unaware of this movie, it is a sequel to The Shining, the classic Stanley Kubrick movie from 1980. The Shining obviously is based on a novel by Stephen King, so is Dr. Sleep. He wrote a follow-up novel years later, and now it has been adapted into a movie. So the interesting thing about this is the book of The Shining and the movie of The Shining are famously pretty different. And this movie tries to be a sequel to the original movie as well as a faithful adaptation of the book. Obviously, changes had to be made, and I am not someone who has read the book, but today's guest has, and he's going to break down all the changes that Mike Flanagan, the writer-director of Dr. Sleep, made in order to put this story together. Dr. Sleep follows the story of Ewan McGregor, who is the grown-up version of Danny from The Shining, now goes by Dan Torrance. There is also a villain played by Rebecca Ferguson named Rose the Hat, and there is a newcomer named Kylie Curran who plays Abra Stone, who is a young woman with the powers of The Shining. And the story follows Dan as he is an adult. He now is struggling with alcoholism in a very similar way that his father was, and he is sort of trying to suppress his shine, which is what they call the powers from The Shining. In the first part of the movie, he sort of starts to accept his abilities and not run from them quite as much and figure out how to use them for good. And in so doing, he meets up with Abra and begins to sort of mentor her as she has a powerful shining powers as well. Now, Abra is aware of the villains here, and that is sort of the setup for this story. The villains of the story are called the True Knot, as in tying a knot, and they are a group of people, maybe not people, inhuman, we're not sure exactly, at least in the movie we're not sure, and they go around capturing children, basically preying upon children that have the Shining, and using them, basically using their power by killing them to stay alive and continue preying on more children. So that is the villains that we're dealing with, and this sort of all comes to a head. If you've seen the trailer, you know we do return to the Overlook Hotel at one point of the story, which is a pretty powerful scene. I'll leave it there and we can get into the conversation. But this week's guest is an amazing filmmaker and actor named Johnny Brannan. If you know anyone in the sort of Central Arkansas film community, you probably have met Johnny. He is the nicest guy you can meet. He has worked on several short and feature-length films as an actor as well as behind the camera in various roles, including as a director. He is also someone who has read many, many Stephen King novels and was so kind to hop on the phone with me to discuss this new movie and all the ways that it interacts with the original film, The Shining, with the book of The Shining and the book of Dr. Sleep, and all of the interesting ways this story was adapted. Johnny also runs the Made in Arkansas Film Festival, which is a festival that celebrates through a few events each year, including their main Made in Arkansas Film Festival, celebrates the filmmaking talents of Arkansans and people connected with Arkansas. They do a lot to promote young filmmakers, so I really applaud the work they do. The Made in Arkansas Film Festival is really a must attend for anyone who is concerned at all with Arkansas and Arkansas film, and that happens each year in the spring. I will link to the Made in Arkansas website in the show notes, as well as Johnny's IMDb page, and you can check out all the film things that he has been involved with. One other note, we keep this conversation spoiler-free for about the first half, first third maybe, and we don't spoil anything about the movie or either of the books that we talk about, but at that point we do get into some spoilers, and there is a warning that will say, hey, you can stop listening now if you have not seen this book, seen this movie. I say book because we also spoil the Dr. Sleep book, as well as the book of The Shining and the original movie The Shining if you have never seen that. So be aware of that spoiler warning about a third of the way through. And without further ado, here is my conversation with Johnny Brennan about Dr. Sleep.
When I was a kid, there was a place. A dark place. They closed it down and let it rot. But the things that lived there... They come back.
We are here with Johnny Brennan, actor and filmmaker. Thank you so much for being here, Johnny.
Thank you for inviting me to be a part of your podcast.
And a big Stephen King fan. So I know you've read The Shining and Dr. Sleep. Is that correct?
Yes.
And
yes,
a lot of other Stephen King books too, yeah?
I have. I'm actually kind of going on this Stephen King journey, I guess. I'm rediscovering like his novel. So every month I'm getting a new book on Audible. And so I'm kind of going back and you know, actually, I think I'm going back in order because I started with Carrie and then hit Salem's Lot. And now I'm back on The Shining. But what got me started really of revisiting his books was the book Dr. Sleep. So, and you know, since I knew that they were going to make a movie out of it, I was like, well, you know, so let's just kind of go back and just get into go through all of his novels and see what happens.
Well, you're the perfect person to talk about this movie with. I think it's interesting. So here's my kind of my setup question. So we live in a world in which we had recently Martin Scorsese writing an op-ed in the New York Times about what is considered true quote-unquote cinema and what isn't. And there's kind of this perceived battle in the movie industry between kind of artsy movies, or at least the way Martin Scorsese was setting it up, artsy movies and then more commercial Marvel movies, capitalism movies, basically. And I was thinking about that as I was watching Dr. Sleep, and I feel like it kind of straddles that line in an interesting way, where The Shining is this universally beloved classic. And then, so on one hand, it's we're all going to be interested in this. On the other hand, you could see it as a cash grab. And what remakes or reboots can we pull out of the woodwork? And Warner Brothers has The Shining. Let's pull that out and make a sequel. It maybe is a little different because there is a book that it's based on. But where do you think Dr. Sleep falls on that spectrum between cash grab and worthy sequel?
Well, that's, I mean, I totally agree with you. It really straddles that line. And I hadn't said anything on, you know, social media about my thoughts on what Martin Scorsese was saying about the Marvel films or superhero films and stuff like that. But, you know, I've been quiet about it because most of my friends are all like big, you know, Marvel, you know, fanboys or fangirls. But, no, I agree with him. I mean, it's two different types. There's two different types. Well, there's a variety of cinema out there. Yeah. And, you know, Marvel is, or DC, whatever, any of those films are kind of its own entity. But I think that, you know, we recognize the classics like, you know, Scorsese's films or who else was there? The Godfather or, you know, you go all the way back to all these different filmmakers, you know, Hitchcock and Spielberg and, you know, all these different filmmakers. It's just such a different time then, and times have changed, and cinema has changed so much. I mean, at a accelerating rate. You know that it's different. We're in a different time. We're in a time where, you know, the way films are made, it's almost like, you know, we let's get to the point as quick as we can. You know, back in the day, you just kind of marinated a movie, and everything was shot differently. You know, the way, you know, you used actual film then, now it's all digital. So yeah, I mean, it's different. Now as far as like, you know, Dr. Sleep goes, I think, you know, Mike Flanagan, you know, did a pretty good job on trying to bring the Kubrick classic along with, you know, his own vision for the film. Yeah. But there's a huge difference between Kubrick and Flanagan. You know what I mean? Kubrick has a very interesting style of directing, and his whole, and you know, of course, if you watch the, you know, I'm sure you've seen the documentary on that, the making of The Shining, and how
I haven't, but I've heard it's so good.
It's, he's a general. So Flanagan, you know, he's he's a new guy. He's on a household name, you know. He's done a couple of remakes, I guess. He did Gerald's Game, and now he's doing this. But I don't know. I think he brought an interesting atmosphere. I say atmosphere being he kind of pulled what he could, I guess, or played homage, or, you know, was showed some inspiration, I guess, from The Shining. And I could see a lot of that in Dr. Sleep, but at the same time, I saw a lot of that whole, the quick cuts, that his editing style, which is so different than what Kubrick's was.
Yeah. You know,
there's a lot of slow dissolves, and there's a lot of lingering moments and stuff like that. But this new film, it looked like almost like anything that you would see today, like an Annabelle or an Insidious or, you know, one of those type of films too. So
I completely agree. Yeah, I think it's kind of a mixed bag for that reason. As far as the Scorsese debate, I mean, I think that's just better or worse the world we live in, and capitalism has affected the movie industry the same way negatively that it affects a lot of other things. But we could do a whole other podcast on that probably. But yeah, I think for me, this movie does, I mean, justify its existence is kind of a weird phrase, but I hear that about movies sometimes. And I think it does because Mike Flanagan clearly does love Stephen King and his story that he, because this isn't, you know, a brand new story. This is based on a book, and I think there's a reference there for it. But that said, I mean, it's hard to compare anything quality wise to The Shining, of course. But this draws that comparison for you. But yeah, so anyway, nowhere near to The Shining, of course. But I did enjoy it overall quite a bit. How does it compare to the book as someone who has not read it? Do you think it's a good adaptation?
Well, let's say this. The Shining and Dr. Sleep really have a whole different vibe from each other, even as the novels go, as far as the novels go. I read The Shining for the first time back in 1996, and it terrified me. I was 24 years old. And 25, I can't remember, 24, I think, maybe. And I slept with the lights on for 3 nights when I went through that book. And when I read Dr. Sleep, it had a different feel. It wasn't as haunting, I guess, because, you know, you it's a whole different, I guess, you know, the bad guy in this one is more of a, it's a different form of you know, you had ghosts, you had possessed, you know, all that stuff, haunting of the hotel itself. But and that, you know, of course, you know, the hotel itself was pretty creepy, and it had a lot of, you know, a lot to it. But, you know, in Dr. Sleep, you got a group called the True Knot, and the book, and maybe it's just because I listened to it on audio, I can't remember the actor who read it, but he does such an incredible job. He makes the characters sound so, you know, creepy and disturbing. But at the same time, King describes them as, you know, you see that whole caravan of Winnebagoes and you know, on the road and stuff like that. You don't even think about, like, you know, who's behind the wheel. And it's just old people wearing, you know, was it rose color, or not rose color, but flower colored shirts, kind of like, you know, those Jimmy Buffett shirts, I guess. Yeah. And khaki pants, and, you know, they look like your grandparents. But the way it was read on the book on audio, I mean, it was, he made it sound like they were really, really creepy people. And so, you know, there was a lot of differences between, as far as like the tone of the books. Same thing with the movie, you know, there's two different tones. But they were, you can definitely feel the connection, of course. And there was it's almost like there was a distant relationship between the two, or maybe a close relationship, you know. But but going back to the book, I thought that I thought he did a really good job on of continuing Danny's story, as far as, like, you know, the first part of the book actually takes place when he's still young, and then it moves into, you know, his adulthood. And we'll get to that part later, but I thought he did a fantastic job of continuing. I felt like the first part of the book felt like The Shining. You know, like, okay, this is still it. You know, this is still that part of the book. So it's pretty creepy. First part of the book, they're pretty, pretty creepy.
That difference in tone, that resonates, because, it is so different. Some people might watch Dr. Sleep and think that the first, I don't know, half of it, or even kind of slow, but I actually really liked that about it. It was really intentional. It ends up being a lot about his recovery from alcoholism and going to AA meetings and all of that. I really liked all that stuff a lot. And then, it, of course, kind of at the beginning and the end, I guess, is where it really ties into The Shining. We can talk about the ending a little later, but the tone is vastly different, and that I thought was a strength of the film. What did you not like about the film?
Well, let's see here. I think some of the editing. Some of the editing just kind of, you know.
You can't compare it to Kubrick when it's The Shining story. So, so the editing especially should be at a high caliber.
You know, and that's the thing. Me as an editor on my own films, I'm not a big fan of dissolve. But, you know, of course, you look at classic cinema, there are so many of them, and it works. And that's that's good. But, like, for my own stuff, I'm just not a big fan of it. And so there's that. But that's on the technical side. On the spot, but if we're going on to like the things that I didn't really care about, Dr. Sleep, was the things they left out. That was the most, you know, there was things in the book. Of course, you know, with every adaption, you're going to lose character development, or you're going to lose key characters or key moments that make the film or make the book. I guess we're talking about the film. Make the film, or could make the film. I don't know. You know, I think it could have like really grabbed people in a variety of different ways. There's a couple of characters that were left out. There are some really interesting plot points, you know, as well that was left out. That I think that, you know, in the book they were like, you know, oh crap moments. You know what I mean? Like, oh my gosh. You know, and so whenever I watched the movie and I thought they left that out, I was like, they could have like, but you know, he had to choose, you know, pick and choose what he wanted to put in this book and this movie. And, I don't know. I just thought that he could have, there's some things that he could have left in that I think, and of course, I'm not going to say much about the ending. The ending of the book is great. It's like so, so good.
And very different from the movie ending.
Absolutely, so different. You know, and so there's, like I said, there's some characters in the book that, you know, that play a bigger part in the film, and they're throughout the film, you know, but he didn't really like capitalize on that for the film. That's the one thing, if I was gonna say I had really any gripes, was what he left out, his choice of leaving certain things out. But it's one of those things, you know, you just kind of, as a director, you know, you gotta, maybe that was him killing his babies. I don't know. I don't know.
So as someone who has not read the book, I really only had one kind of big level complaint, and that was the True Knot, the villains, especially Rose. They just didn't quite connect with me. I don't know, they felt, maybe I was expecting the tone of The Shining, but they felt almost a little silly or campy or something at times, and it didn't quite jive with the rest of what I was experiencing. And then we'll get into the ending again a little bit later, but the way that played into the ending as well, I just didn't quite love, but... Well, actually, let's go ahead. So let's talk spoilers, because I want to go and jump into that.
Okay, cool.
So if you have not watched Dr. Sleep...
I feel like I'm holding my breath. Yeah. I'm like... Okay.
Let's go ahead. So if you have not watched Dr. Sleep, you can tune out now and listen to this later. But so as Rose the Hat is the villain, as she goes, and it wasn't like it was a bad performance or anything. I think it's just that character just feels out of place somehow. And so I almost have this... As I wrote in my notes, actually, like, they're treading on holy ground, because The Shining is so beloved, and it's like, how can you go to the Overlook Hotel and not, you know, there's just such a reverence there that to even go there felt a little bit like sacrilegious or something. And then especially when we had Rose the Hat, who I didn't really love, tromping around in the Overlook Hotel, and that was the moment when it's like, what have they done to The Shining? Like, here's this silly character that's kind of come into this holy place in my brain, and it's like ruining it. So that's probably an extreme reaction. I have too much spiritual connection to The Shining, but I just didn't love that. I like that they went back to the Overlook. I knew that was going to happen from trailers and everything. And I was curious about how that would happen. And as far as like how that all played out in the end, I didn't really have any gripes with the plot. Like, you know, if a villain's going to be there, and then the sicking the ghosts on her and all of that, I thought that worked pretty well, actually. It was really just the villains of the whole piece I didn't totally love. But
yeah, the interesting thing about that is that Rose the Hat in the book, she was described, to me, I thought she was much older than what she was. I thought that Rebecca Ferguson did a pretty good job at it. She's getting praised for her performance by a lot of
critics. Actress, yeah.
I thought she did really good. There was several people in the True Knot that they left out of the book. Well, when they got the snake bite Andy, she was older in the book, and there was actually a little bit of a romance between her and Rose the Hat.
Oh, interesting.
Rose the Hat pushed her off onto another woman, so there was a relationship between Snakebite and some a woman named, I think, Silent Surrey was her name, and so she played a bigger part in the book. Now, sticking with the book here, there was no Overlook in the book.
Because
in the original signing, the Overlook just was, you know, it blew up.
So like the same thing that happened in the ending of this happened actually in the ending of the book of The Shining.
So there was no Overlook. So what in the book, the Overlook, or where the Overlook was, is a campground, and the True Knot own it, or they run it or something.
Wow.
So there's actually a staircase that goes out, that kind of like you can go out and look over the mountains of Colorado, and it's called like the staircase to the end of the world or something like that. And it's like the last remaining part of the Overlook. So, so whenever there's the big fight that happens, you know, in the movie, they actually go to this campsite in the book to have this big battle. And Rose the Hat, I mean, if you think about it, like from the movie perspective, the True Knot really never stood a chance. And it's same thing in the book. As much as Rose the Hat, you know, was supposed to be like the fearsome leader, she was not, never really had a chance against Abra Stone, the girl. Because Abra's character in the book was like, you know, Danny in The Shining was like this little nuclear bomb when it comes to like his powers, you know. What's his name? Scatman Crothers' character, Dick Halloran. When Dick Halloran told him that, you know, you can, you know, just yell at me, I'll be in Florida if anything happens to you here. In the book, he screams out his, you know, Dick, help me, or whatever. And it hit him so hard, it bloodied his nose from Florida. Well, this girl, Abra, is like 100 times stronger than Danny was when he was a little boy.
Oh, wow.
So she can, like, she's like the most powerful, you know, kid with a signing, or with a sign gift. So that's why Rose and then went after her, of course. So, but the thing is that, you know, she was a lot, I'll say, a little bit more threatening in the book. But she, if you watch the movie, if you go see it again, if you watch closely, they really never had a chance. There was never a threat of them capturing her and doing what they were going to. And the same thing goes for the book. She never really had that much of a shot, but there's like I said, there's a lot more in the book. Like they touched on her grandmother for like a second. Her mom to see her grandmother. Her grandmother played a huge part in the book, and she and Abra were much closer. And then you got some of the characters that Dan became friends with, like Billy Freeman, the man who went with him to Iowa to find the baseball boy. Billy Freeman lives in the book, and he didn't die. The doctor that he told her to watch was in the movie. He was a big part in the book, and he actually was Abra's child doctor. So there was that connection there. That's how Dan and her got that. They were like, you know, because the family were like, okay, why are you talking to this, you know, why are you talking to this man? And the doctor's like, you know, he's a friend of mine. And so he kind of connected all that stuff there. But here's one of the biggest things they left out of the movie that I wish they were left in there. So in the book, Dan's character is, they call him Dr. Sleep because when patients, start to, and the cat, of course, the cat was in the book and everything. Mm-hmm. When people would pass over or whenever they would die, Dan would, do what he did in the film. Well, the girl's, Abra's grandmother was going to pass with cancer. So he went through her mind and saw that Jack, his dad, when he was young, he was teaching in New Hampshire, and he had an affair with her daughter. So it turns out that Jack's half-sister, or Danny's half-sister, is Abra's mom.
Wow, okay.
So that's how how they got that connection there. So he really is her Uncle Dan.
Wow. Yeah, and I didn't even, that it was just like an honorary uncle in the movie. That's very interesting. Wow.
Very. So, and there's also a character in the, okay, I'll go ahead and go to the ending, because this is where I love the book. So in the book, there was a security officer that worked with Dan. He was kind of a jerk to all the patients, and he'd abuse them. And he was just a really mean guy. And Dan threatened him, and he said, if you ever touch these patients again, I'll beat you till you're dead or whatever. Mm-hmm. Well, at the end of the book, of course, Dan's alive. He celebrates 15 years of sobriety and whatever, and everybody's alive. Billy Freeman, the doctor, everybody. And so while he's at this hospice, that security guard is actually dying, and he asks for Dan to come and kind of basically send him off. And it's a really sweet ending. It's sad, but it's a happy ending. And so Dan lives, they all live. But that's the thing that just crushed me,
vastly different. I'm appreciating a little bit more Mike Flanagan's predicament, though, because how can you not make a sequel to The Shining and bring in some of that iconography, but then how do you do that if the Overlook Hotel is destroyed in the book? And
I think with what he did in the film with, having all the spirits, because in the book, that Silent Surrey was, they were actually going to ambush Dan when they showed up to the Overlook campground. And then he started opening up his mind. Like, he started opening up those boxes, and Horace Derwent shows up. It's actually a creepy moment in the book where she's in a shed and she's waiting to jump out, and then Horace Derwent's like right behind her in the dark, and he's like, great party, isn't it? And then he attacks her. So it's like, oh my god. And the same thing, like at the very beginning in the book, Miss Massey, the woman in the tub. Mm-hmm. In the book, it's just as creepy as you got to see on the screen. So that was actually, I was like, oh, this is so good. I was wondering if they're going to keep that in the movie or not. And I was really glad that they did.
Yeah. I liked how they brought the ghost back and all the callbacks there. Yeah. I liked the ending of this. I liked the whole thing. That's really interesting.
Played a small part in the book. He kind of showed up like somewhere in the middle. He had already died. He'd been dead for a long time, and Dan didn't even know it. And so Dan Googled him, and he found out. And then while one of the patients, when he was sitting one of the patients, putting him to sleep, Dick came back to that person, and told him how to, I can't remember if he told him how to beat Rose the Hat, or he said something to him. He kind of gave him some type of inspiration and some kind of closure. I think it was like closure. And then he was gone. Dick Hollering had like a very, very small part in the book. But yeah. I kind of wish they would have left that in there too. Like that, Dick just shows up and you're like, oh, because it would have been a sweet moment.
Yeah, instead of him being like the spiritual guru.
Oh, look, there's Dick again.
Yeah. Yeah. So speaking of him, did you think that was a good impression of previous Dick? And I thought it was pretty solid. And then how do you think comparing Dan's mother, and then so we have basically a Jack Nicholson lookalike, right, at the bar. It was a little ambiguous about whether that was supposed to be him or not. What did you think about all that?
I liked it. And so, of course, after reading the book, and I went to IMDb, and I was looking at the cast, and I saw that there was a person cast as Wendy and a person cast as, Dick and Danny. And I go, oh, cool, they're bringing them back. I thought the woman who played Wendy nailed it. Like, really? Every little, like, her, the voice, course, you know, if you look really close at her hair when they're watching TV, her ear is kind of poking out underneath her hair. And I remember that in The Shining specifically. Mm, that used to kind of bother me.
But like, they brought it back. That's great.
Yeah, like they were really like, I mean, the robe that she wore was exactly from The Shining. Mm. Everything when she was running across the whenever Dan and Dick was talking about the boxes by the by the ocean,
that was the moment when I was like sold, when her voice, when it was like high pitched, because I actually just rewatched most of The Shining this week to kind of prepare, and I was like, wow, that sounds just like Shelley Duvall,
just like her. And I was just like, holy cow. And and I thought that was, I thought she did, you know, I thought the little boy played Danny did a pretty good job.
Yeah.
But the guy who played Dick, I thought he did good. Here's something interesting. Whenever the Jack Nicholson Lloyd situation, which I thought was great, actually. He tied in, I think, Flanagan tied in that part, of the book with Kubrick right there. Mm. It's almost like he tied it in like a little knot for, I think, Stephen King, because he brought up the whole, you know, you're take your medicine like a pup, be a good pup and take your medicine. And that was all throughout The Shining. Mm. You know, he had a croquet mallet and he was, you know, running after Danny and he was like, come take your medicine, you know. So when he put that in there, I was like, because we didn't see that in Kubrick's. I thought that right there ties everything together. And I thought that, you know, I thought the guy, it was kind of neat because he didn't look just like, you know, Jack Nicholson, but he had a similarity to, you knew it was Jack Torrance.
Yeah, his voice was more like Lloyd's, though, actually, because at first I was like, why don't they make it digitally sound more like Jack Nicholson's growling or something? But then I was like, you know what, it kind of sounds like Lloyd, so there's that interesting combination there. You know, I just looked it up on IMDb, and the person listed as Jack Torrance in Dr. Sleep is Henry Thomas, who is the kid from E.T., who plays Elliot.
Oh, you serious?
That's wild. I'm looking at his picture. It's him.
I didn't even think about that.
That's wild.
Holy, well, this is interesting too, and this is something that's a little far off, but Henry Thomas shot a film here in Arkansas.
Oh, really? Oh, wow.
8 years ago called The Last Ride, and he played Hank Williams Sr. in his last 4 days of being alive, and they shot it all here in Little Rock, Benton and stuff. But anyway, that's a whole different.
It looks like he's also a character in The Haunting of Hill House, which is Mike Flanagan as well. So I guess they have a little bit of a relationship.
Makes
there.
A lot of sense.
There you go.
I totally forgot about that.
Wow.
And he was also in Gerald's Game.
Oh, yeah, which is another Stephen King adaptation directed by Mike Flanagan, right? I wondered if he almost like earned his keep to be able to make this movie from doing a good job with that, because I've heard Gerald's Game is pretty good.
It is. Actually, Gerald's Game was a really good adaptation. Yes, I agree.
Wow.
Go ahead. Yeah, that's wild. I totally did not even like put that. Wow.
He was pretty well disguised, I think, under makeup and stuff, but I just clicked on it and I was like, oh my gosh, that's him. Well, I really liked about this movie. So I rewatched part of The Shining, most of it. I ran out of time, but I hadn't seen The Shining since college. It'd been several years, and I was just I realized when I watched it back then, I think I had a DVD full screen edition. So it wasn't like, it wasn't even letterboxed. I was like, oh my gosh, this looks so much better than I remember. But then just the themes of addiction and alcoholism being so much stronger than I remembered. I was a kid back then. I didn't pick up everything, but now I'm a father. So that maybe there's a level of seeing the stresses of a father and then putting alcoholism with that and seeing how it exploded and kind of how Kubrick was sort of exploiting some of those fears of parenting and alcoholism and then how this movie picks that up and has a pretty redemptive arc. Again, very different than the book, it sounds like. But I liked that it went to AA. I thought some of the best moments for me were he's having his AA, 6 month sober speech, and he said this is for Jack Torrance, and my father never made it this far in his sobriety. I thought that was really beautiful. And then what you said is straight from the book, the hospice, how he's using that, The Shining, to kind of help people on their deathbeds. And I thought that was really, just really beautiful. And kind of you see just the redemption of him going from maybe wishing he didn't have The Shining and suppressing it, and his powers are a problem for him, to full circle, he can see how, what was the quote? You're exactly where you're supposed to be. And he was using those for good. And I think that's a kind of a cool thing.
Yep. I agree with you. It's interesting because I thought that the film of Dr. Sleep was a little bit more personal when it comes to the alcoholism and stuff. Because in The Shining, you know, we knew about it. Mm-hmm. But it didn't seem like it hung over his head a whole lot. Mm-hmm. It seemed like there's other things. But that's I think that could be, I might be Stephen King toying with my head of him just not being a big fan of the film version. But mm-hmm. I thought in the book, of course, the book The Shining, it was just as equal as Dr. Sleep when it came to really touching on his alcoholism and, you know, the things that it was doing, you know, doing towards him, but also just like you said, you know, Danny redeeming himself and going to AA, and that's the thing. It's like in the book, you know, he's doing AA and it's like 15 years later, and you know, he's up there and it's really cool.
With a beautiful ending, yeah, and using that,
yeah.
That yeah, all lost in the film version.
I know. Yeah. That's the heartbreak that I wish that, you know. But take, you know, it's a great adaptation of it. I thought even with the things that I wish he would have kept in, I thought he did a great job tying both together. And you know, of course, being a fan of The Shining, you can't have The Shining without The Overlook, you know. And but Kubrick didn't destroy the Overlook in the original, so it's still there. But I thought whenever they mentioned that, yeah, it's still here. And well, we saw in the trailer too that he was going to go back to the Overlook, and I was just kind of curious on what exactly we were going to get to see. I loved it. I thought it was great.
It's probably fortuitous that Kubrick did not destroy the Overlook, because I cannot imagine this movie could have gotten made if the Overlook did not exist anymore. Right? Like, if this movie didn't have any connections to The Shining visually, I don't think it would sell at all. I just can't imagine that it would exist. So no, thank you, Stanley Kubrick, for that. One other thing that I thought was kind of interesting. I recently rewatched It Chapter 1, and as I was preparing for It Chapter 2, and another kind of just parallel there that I thought was interesting was the quote that I always remember from It Chapter 1 is Beverly says when they're kind of deciding, hey, we need to go fight Pennywise, and they're like, no, we can't do it, and they all kind of start infighting. But she says, I want to run towards something, not away. And that kind of is a big theme of like her whole life. If she's responding in fear to something that that's not a good way to live. And I think that parallels what Dan does here, because when Abra first says, hey, there's these villains out there that we need to deal with, let's go get them. And he says, hide, like shut down, like you have to stay away, it's too dangerous. And you're saying that wouldn't have even been believable in the book because she was so powerful. But I think that was interesting. His first response was like, we got to run away. But then he comes full circle on that too, and kind of has a similar journey to maybe Beverly from It, as we have to fight. And as I was thinking about that, I think you can almost see the True Knot as sort of like symbolizing mental illness at all. I thought of that when they made his friend commit suicide, Billy. And so they're sort of preying on people's vices and like twisting that kind of stuff. But then you could almost see the ending arc for Dan as well, as he's tempted to relapse, and he almost does at one point. He has a bottle, which was an interesting moment, and then at the bar as well, there's the drink in front of him, and so it's this tempting, is he going to break his sobriety and relapse, and sort of by facing his demons and coming to terms with maybe his childhood, he is able to continue that and have, instead of going from cycle of abuse, you know, his father was an alcoholic, now he's an alcoholic, turning it into a cycle of redemption and passing on, and then there's a cycle of passing this on to the younger generation as he's feeding into Abra. So I thought that all worked really nicely, and I appreciate that about the script.
Yeah, and well, here's the thing that was really, really interesting, and it's a book thing that a small thing in a book was when the True Knot got a hold of the baseball boy, it turns out that he had measles. So whenever they took his steam, they all caught measles.
Wow.
So each one of them were dying. And so and that was another little plot point, was that they thought that Abra could heal them, but they're all going out like pretty quick. They were like Grandpa Flick, whenever he was laying there, you know, kind of cycling, And that's exactly how I pictured it in my mind when I discovered the book. It was part of measles, like everybody had it. And so I thought that was interesting that they left that out. But
did they all die in about 10 seconds the way they did in the movie? I was like, oh, wow, there goes all the true.
Oh, no. They were kind of split up. Mm. Like Crodaddy and a few of the guys went, you know, to find her in New Hampshire or wherever they were at. Then the rest of them stayed with Rose the Hat in Colorado. So, and there was actually a lot more. I believe there was a lot more.
Huh. But, yeah, there was something like 8 or something in the movie.
Yeah, I think that whenever, I can't remember what it was in the book. I need to go back and read it again. I've already read it twice, but I think the measles did most, like a lot of the damage, if I'm not mistaken. Because everybody just started like, shoot, I'm sick. So, yeah, and then they're like, okay, well, now we got to get this girl steam because if we get it, then they should be able to save us. And because she was so powerful and stuff. But,
another interesting
thing. Yeah, I totally forgot about that, actually. Yeah. I was like,
Well, it's hard to say. Like, so do you overall think it's a good adaptation? It sounds like it's a really difficult thing to adapt.
I do. Yes, it was. I mean, it really was. And if he would have, the thing is if he would have adapted it the way King wrote it, it would have been its own film, or it wouldn't have felt like a Shining, because a Kubrick Shining.
Yeah.
But I do like that he did take into consideration, hey, look, I gotta pull these two together. It's almost like, he actually kind of like took Stephen King's hand, took Kubrick's hand, and had them lock fingers and say, look, you know, we're all going to get along now.
Yeah.
And because Stephen King apparently loves this version. He says that he felt like Mike Flanagan redeemed Kubrick's.
Yeah, which is very interesting. So he's pretty picky, right?
Oh, totally. And the way he describes it, you can look it up online. It's kind of graphic. But the way he describes it, you get the feeling that King really, really hated that version of The Shining.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's interesting enough is that, you know, there was a 1997 version of The Shining, too. I kind of like wrote that one off, though. I never really got into it, and
Stephen King likes that one better.
It was closer to the novel. Mm. It was a lot closer to the novel, and there's a lot of people that was in the book that was in in Kubrick's film. You know, when Wendy was running around the hotel, when the hotel was finally showing itself, like all the ghosts were coming out. You're like, what is that? And what exactly, like when I was a kid.
Yeah, it's pretty confusing and jarring,
She runs up the stairs, and when I was a kid, it kind of always messed with my head because there's that scene where if you're that long shot down the hallway where that person, what looks like they're in a bear outfit.
Yeah, yeah.
Like sits up and looks down, and then, well, in the book, it explains who that person was, and that wasn't a bear outfit. That was a dog outfit.
Mm-hmm.
And that person is a pretty mean person and pretty psychotic. I don't even think that person showed up in the with all the other ghosts.
Yeah, but I
don't know. The twins wasn't in the Doctor Sleep sequel either. But that's the thing. You know,
that's one of those that you can't leave out if you're paying homage in a way. So so it seems like it's interesting that you said Stephen King sort of. It feels like this is redeemed because it sort of takes the Kubrick version, takes Stephen King's vision, and then also in a way that studio I'm sure was happy with, makes this sort of mass marketable. So it really is a kind of a perfect marriage of back to that original question of, is this just a cash grab or true art? And marries the two really nicely. So way to go, Mike Flanagan.
I think it's like the perfect time if it's going to come out. Well, yeah. I think Shining came out in 1980. This came out in 2019. I think that it's I was curious to see what happened to Danny when he grew up too. You know, like Stephen King's been saying in his interviews, like, what happened to Danny? I'm kind of curious now if he's going to like do that with any other characters. Like, whatever happened to Carrie? Well, we know what happened to Carrie White, but whatever happened to what was her name from Firestarter? Her character that. Or
But there's this whole universe that he could continue expanding and do that kind of thing with. That's really interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And So yeah, what can you do? But yeah. I don't know. I thought it was I thought he did a fantastic job of uniting the two films, connecting the two films together, and yeah, I don't know. I'm just kind of curious to see how well it's going to go. And if there's any deleted scenes when the DVD comes out, I'm curious if there's anything they shot that they didn't put in the film.
That will be interesting to see. And yeah, I also am very interested to see what the box office does for this, because I could see it doing really well, but I could also potentially see it bombing. So fingers crossed that it just finds its audience, because I think it's worth it. And I really did appreciate it. But we should probably wrap up a little bit time-wise. Thank you so much for joining me. Was there any last words about Dr. Sleep you want to throw in the ring?
Definitely read the book. Read the book. For anything like to fill in the gaps, I urge it any be more like I'm passionate about my urging of definitely read the book for sure.
But you need to read The Shining first as well. Yeah.
Yes. And I'm actually doing it right now. I'm actually in the middle of the audiobook right now.
Well, there's your homework. Read two really big books. But it's made me really want to jump into some Stephen King. I actually have never read anything by Stephen King at all. It's time, I think. But.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed it, you can leave a rating or review. If you didn't enjoy it, leave a rating and review and let us know how we can be improving. You can keep tuning into the Art House Garage podcast every other Monday. And if you want more from Art House Garage, you can follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. We have been doing some videos on IGTV as well as on YouTube. And of course, at arthousegarage.com, you can read blog posts and reviews all about movies and keeping it snob free. On all the social media platforms, as well as on Letterboxd, you can follow us at Art House Garage. Thank you so much for listening, and till next time, keep it snob free. Thanks, guys.